This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is Oklahoma Republican freshman Congressman James Lankford, who is also a member of the House Budget Committee. We want to get his thoughts on the aftermath of the fierce debate over the raising of the debt ceiling in the U.S. Congress and ultimately why he decided to vote for the compromise, which easily cleared both the House and Senate and was signed into law today by the president. And Congressman, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Glad to be with you.
Ultimately, it came down to a meeting in the middle here. You had a lot of folks on the conservative side saying it wasn't good enough. You had a lot of folks on the Democratic side saying it was a giveaway to Republicans. And in the middle, of course, was the majority where you were. Ultimately, what was the final factor in your decision to support this legislation?
Yeah, the very beginning of this fight, we're talking back in January, February, there's a whole group of us that were saying the prime thing that we're looking for is a long-term structural reforms. Anything that we can get that drives us to structural reforms, that's what we're going to focus in on. And while there were some guys that were saying we didn't cut enough, I would assure you, I agree with that. We didn't cut near enough of what we need to do, and we're going to continue to have serious issues, and hopefully we'll continue to stay on message in our appropriations process. The gain of this thing was a serious, real vote coming up this fall on a balanced budget amendment that's not happened in 15 years in the Congress. Getting that back front and center becomes a big deal for us, and the statutory caps that are there. And while some people doubt or don't doubt those statutory caps, they worked in the 1990s. That was the buildup where Bill Clinton takes credit for having balanced his budget in the mid-1990s. The groundwork for that was laid in the early 90s, late 1980s, with the process of putting statutory caps in place, and they worked.
Well, let's talk about each of those separately, starting where you finished, and that's with the caps, because you had some on the Senate floor and the House floor saying that they were unenforceable spending caps. You clearly disagree. Explain why you think these will hold fast.
Yeah, it was funny. I heard a senator this morning that was saying those caps are completely unenforceable the way that they're written, and yada, yada, yada. The Senate will do what they want to, and I laughed because it was the same senator that just 3 weeks ago was saying how much he was supportive of cut, cap, and balance. They're the exact same mechanism as what was in cut, cap, and balance was carried over into this piece, and the piece that we passed yesterday, I'm telling you, the DNA of it is cut, cap, and balance. It didn't cut as much as we wanted to do. The cap was higher than we wanted it to be, but the mechanism is the same, and it directs us towards a balanced budget amendment. The cap itself, what it does is it flattens spending for the next 10 years. Next year, discretionary spending will be lower by $7 billion or $22 billion, depending on whether you're looking at outlays or budget authority and all that Washington game. Either one of them, it's lower next year. So it'll be 2 years in a row that in discretionary spending, the federal government actually spends less than they did the year before. And that is a definite change in what we've been doing. Then the next year, it rises by only $4 billion. Every year after that, in the next eight, it doesn't even rise as much as inflation. Inflation is about 3% typically a year. It rises less than 2% a year. So it keeps us flat in real dollars over the next 10 years. That has not occurred in a very long time, if ever, has that occurred. Now, while it doesn't turn down our spending, and that was my hope to be able to do that, it takes us from growing, which we've done the last 2 years, 25% over the last 2 years in discretionary spending, down to zero. And to be able to shift that down. So that's the right direction to go. We're taking it from climbing to flat. The next step is then to declining.
One of the big concerns, Congressman, was that future Congresses could easily ignore this. Are you saying these caps are binding on future Congresses as well?
They are binding on future Congresses because it's basically a budget act. They're going to have to pass a new budget act, which means the House and the Senate are going to have to agree together to create a new budget act. That can be done, obviously, as any Congress can, but this sets the ground rules, and they have to have 60 votes in the Senate to be able to do that. So you're going to have a significant number of Republicans that are going to have to give in to do that over on the Senate side, and we'd obviously have to lose the House for that to accomplish. So statutory caps work as long as you've got a Congress that's committed to it. They worked for about 6 or 7 years back in the 1990s and were effective. We were hoping to get that length of time out of these, and then by the end of that have a balanced budget amendment in place to force it long term.
Let's talk about the balanced budget amendment now. Of course, in cut, cap, and balance, the rest of the bill, the cutting and the capping, were contingent upon the approval and the ratification of a balanced budget amendment. Now, of course, it's not contingent on that, but there is a requirement for a vote to happen. The numbers situation is still the same, where you'll need two-thirds in both chambers, and the Democrats have made it clear that they don't like this. So what is the significance of having the debate, even though it's likely to probably not get the two-thirds?
Well, I'm not as convinced on that. The Democrats that I've talked to don't like the 18% balanced budget amendment. We have said to multiple Democrats, hey, the Constitution is not owned by the Republican Party, though I personally think Republicans follow it more than Democrats, but that's my personal preference and opinion. It is a document that's owned by all Americans. And so this has to be a bipartisan agreement on it. So we're trying to draw up and have Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate, to be able to sit down and start working on what would that text be. Let me tell you how close we have been. I'm sure you know this well. In 1995, it was a wide bipartisan majority, 300 votes in the House to pass a balanced budget amendment. It failed in the Senate by a single vote. So we have been that close, and that has not come back up again in 15 years after failing by one vote in the Senate. There has not been a time in American history that we've been more focused on the debt than right now. So I would submit this is a great time to be able to bring this up again. What's unique about the way that this agreement was made, there are three different ways that the president gets his second installment on the debt ceiling this fall. Way number one is this select committee comes up with this $1.5 trillion in cuts. And then he's able to get a $1.5 trillion amount. Now, a lot of people have been skeptical about the work of a select committee. If that doesn't work, the second option is to do a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. If the House and the Senate both pass it, send it to the states, immediately that $1.5 trillion is also added into the debt ceiling. The third way to do it is what they call a sequester. That is when neither one of those options work and there's an automatic across-the-board cut in every area except for Social Security, Medicaid, and veterans. The other areas all have an across-the-board cut. No one wants that. That is the same as what we had back in the 1990s with the Graham Redmond Hollings piece. It was never implemented because no one ever wants that to occur, which means since we don't want that last one to occur, the incentive is for the balanced budget amendment or for the select committee to come into place. That's the only way for the second installment of this to come out. The easiest of the two is the balanced budget amendment.
Well, let's talk about special committees here, because obviously that's what comes next in this whole process. This committee that will feature six members from each party, six from each chamber. Its work will supposedly be done by just before Thanksgiving, and then the rest of Congress will have a chance to vote up or down by Christmas. The concern from those on the right who oppose this legislation was that this could easily be a vehicle for tax increases, despite the fact that the bulk of Republicans don't want that. They say all it takes is one weak link among the six Republicans, as they see it, to push that forward. And then Congress is either in a position to accept tax hikes that they don't want, certainly on the House side, or they're forced to accept massive cuts in defense spending. So what would you say to those who are concerned about the way that this committee's set up and what happens if they don't come to an agreement that the rest of Congress is okay
with?
Yeah,
it is set up still where their work still has to come back through the House and the Senate to be approved by 51%. So if it comes back with tax increases and comes back with all kinds of stuff that the rest of the House is not going to support, it's not going to pass. And then the pressure is off of us. Then we would say, how about a balanced budget amendment? Because that's the other way that this is advanced. So that, again, it goes back to the incentive in this whole, in the whole way it's structured, is if there are major tax increases and this is going to be a stinky plan, we still have in the House a fallback option, a balanced budget amendment. We just vote down the select committee by 51%, and which is an easy mark, obviously, when we have 240 Republicans, and step back and say, Senate, pass the balanced budget amendment, and this thing moves forward.
Last topic, it's certainly been in the headlines the last few days. How would you describe the state of the conference, given the feistiness over the last couple of weeks?
It has been feisty, and I tell you, the difference of opinion has not been a difference in who's more conservative than the other. It is strategy, and that's the frustration. Some people are saying, let the economy fall, let everything fall apart, they'll come begging back to us, and we'll get even more the next time. Others are saying every time we get in there and start making a deal, it gets worse every time. It's not getting better. And so we want to continue to make forward progress on that, and we want to do it the best way we possibly can and not have the collapse of the economy in the process of trying to prove a point. Ultimately, I think after 7 months of talking about this and talking about it and talking about it, I think a lot of people had a very high expectation of what we could pull off, in fact, an unrealistic expectation of what we could accomplish in one bill. It's been years since Congress has dealt with serious spending cuts and statutory caps, and it's been 15 years, obviously, since we've had a balanced budget amendment. And so everybody wanted in one bill to solve all the nation's fiscal problems, and we're just not going to be able to get that done. This is going to be a 10-year process to fight through every 6 months. So for any of the folks listening that think the battle's over, they need to understand this is the very first battle in a very long war that we're going to have against debt. Don't underestimate how bad it really is. 14 now headed towards almost $17 trillion in debt in the next year and a half. It's really bad, and we're going to have to do some major shifting of how we do spending and what we do as a nation to be able to get on top of this.
Well, Congressman, take a deep breath. As you mentioned, this is just the first step in a big, long fight on this issue to get their fiscal house in order. Thank you very much for your time, as always.
No, you're very welcome.
Thank you, sir. Oklahoma Republican Congressman James Lankford represents his state's 5th Congressional District, member of the House Budget Committee. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.